or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Consciously or not, we're always making ethical choices, or unethical choices, in and out of the workplace, and Peter Singer argues that we often do so poorly. The New Yorker called him the planet's most influential living philosopher. Time listed him as among the world's 100 most influential people. He is professor of ethics at Princeton, has co-authored 13 books, is sole author of 16 more, including Practical Ethics, another called The Life You Can Save, and his just published Ethics in the Real World, 82 brief essays on things that matter. I had the privilege of interviewing him as the eminence interview in Psychology Today, and now it's my equal privilege to welcome him here on Work with Marty Nimco. Peter Singer, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be with you.
Great. Well, there is an issue that is foundational to your views on work-related matters that we should discuss up front. The pool of the affluent has greater potential to make a difference, to create jobs, to cure disease, to wisely lead organizations, than does the pool of people in the poorest countries. And yet you advocate rich people donating to charities that serve the poorest countries. You call yourself a utilitarian. As such, how do you justify that position?
I justify that position because I think it's a lot easier to raise the welfare of people who are extremely poor in the poorest countries and the poorest of those in the poorest countries. It's a lot easier to raise their welfare than to raise the welfare of people who are in wealthy countries and are not, in absolute terms, nearly as badly off. So I certainly accept that the affluent has a pool of an enormous amount of talent and resources, and what I'm asking is that they apply that talent and resources to where it can do the most good. And I believe one of the places, maybe not the only place, but one of the places where it can do the most good is by directing it towards benefiting people who are among the worst off in the world.
And some would say that the constellation of problems that those people in the poorest countries of the world is so mammoth that the utility of a given dollar or hour or a person's time, say, let's just take here in California, there are blue-collar gifted kids who are really ignored. Gifted programs for gifted kids have been eviscerated, and these kids have tremendous potential but are not wealthy, and they're utterly ignored. And yet they have a much smaller constellation of problems than, say, somebody in rural Burundi. So could an argument not be made that really, from a utilitarian perspective, that rich person would be wiser to devote their attentions to a pool of people with a less pervasive and devastating constellation of problems?
I don't agree that the constellation of problems in developing countries is always so devastating. And I think precisely because they're so poorly off, small things can make a big difference. I mean, you may be right that there are bright blue-collar people in California who are not getting all of the opportunities that they should, but they are getting the opportunity to attend school. And you know, there are kids in the developing world who are not even getting that opportunity to attend school, or if they do, the school could more easily be improved than the schools in California, or at least at lower cost. I think there are great opportunities for spotting talented people who will do a lot of good in the world in developing countries. You might have noticed that there's a film just out now, Queen of Katwe, about a Kenyan girl who was more or less accidentally came into contact with chess, and through learning chess rose to become one of the best chess players in Kenya, best junior chess players in Kenya, and has been able to have a career through that. So, you know, that's an example, I think, of how at very low cost we can help people to realize their potential in developing countries.
One more push at this. Of course, we can always cherry-pick outliers, but when you take an average person in rural Burundi and you help him or her to learn to read on a, you know, instead of be completely illiterate, read on a fifth grade level or seventh grade level, which would be a Herculean task, the amount of likely ripple effect of that human being on the world, even his or her sphere of influence, would seem to be smaller than the blue-collar person in California who otherwise might just be a, you know, an unemployed rock musician and instead realize that he or she had great talent in crafting the art of persuasion and becoming an excellent political leader, a nonprofit leader, a corporate leader. Wouldn't, on average, statistically, in two parallel universes, the world in which the rich donated their money and time to those California blue-collar ignored people net yield better benefit to the world than spending the equal amount of resources on the rural people of Burundi?
I don't know that you can really make that claim empirically. I think that you have to take into account the great difference in the cost of changing the education of people in blue-collar people in California. You also have to take into account the fact that Burundi needs talented people. Yes, some of them, you know, may simply move from illiteracy to reading at fifth grade level, but some of them may go on from there, and some of them may become political leaders, business leaders, tech leaders in Burundi. I don't think we should discount that possibility.
Fair
and
enough.
If they do, then they may benefit their country more because there are fewer people of that level of education and talent in Burundi. They may benefit their country more than the Californian will benefit the United States.
Fair enough. I thought it was important for that prerequisite, that underpinning philosophy, to be fleshed out on both sides before we turn to what we have to turn because of the scope of the show, to work. So now let us turn to work. First, let me let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Peter Singer. He's the author of many books, most recently just published Ethics in the Real World, 82 Brief Essays on Things That Matter. And one of the things that matters certainly is work. What are the ethical... I was fascinated by our discussion when I did interview you for Psychology Today. There really are ethical trade-offs in choosing to work for Wall Street versus, say, working at the Against Malaria Foundation that are not so obvious. What are the trade-offs?
Right. So one of the trade-offs, assuming that you have the talent and ability to work for Wall Street and to land a high-paying job in Wall Street, one of the trade-offs, of course, is that you can earn a lot of money, and so you can donate a lot of money. So the person who gets a job where they're earning, let's say, $200,000 a year, can comfortably donate $100,000 a year and still live very well. And I know people who have been doing exactly that and more. In fact, as the years go by, they're earning more and they're donating more. So there's the big plus. You can donate large amounts and you can choose the most effective charities that you can find to donate them to. So by donating that kind of sum, they could, for example, create a new position, hire someone who would be doing a great deal of good, or they could buy lots of anti-mosquito nets to protect children against malaria. They could do many, many good things with that kind of sum. Now, if instead you went to work for the nonprofit yourself, you would also be doing good. And for some people, that may be the best career choice that they can make. They could be great doing that. But depending on the pool of available talent for that nonprofit, it may be that you make only a marginal difference. You're only slightly better than the person who would have got the job if you had not been an applicant. And so it may be that the small difference that exists between you and the second best applicant is much less significant than the possibility of creating an entire new position and putting on a dynamic new person who can do a lot of good for the nonprofit, or, as I say, you know, buying more bed nets or deworming a lot of kids, whatever else it might be. It may be that the donation is your most cost-effective way of making a positive difference.
Counter-argument is that for every, you know, when you're young, you tend to be more idealistic. And so there could be, out of every 100 people who say, you know what, I'm going to go to Wall Street, but I'm going to donate large amounts of money to the most effective charity I can, there probably are 50 or 80 or 90. Most of us end up leaving their money to our kids, you know, even when they're rich and they're going to spend it on jewelry. So, you know, the notion is that in making that career, that pivotal career decision to work for the investment banking, saying that down the road when I'll make all this money, I'll donate, is going to, for many of them, from a utilitarian perspective, not be less efficacious than working for a carefully chosen. Let's agree that ineffective nonprofits are bad. Working for them or donating them is a bad choice. But let's agree that the Against Malaria Foundation is a wonderful charity. Lots of bang for the buck. Let's agree with you that helping the least among us, in the poorest countries is wise. When day is done, again in the two parallel universes, won't greater good accrue for those people with the potential, as you say, to work on Wall Street, nonetheless opting to say, I'm going to work for the Against Malaria Foundation and its equivalents?
Well, I'm not really talking about people who just go to work for Wall Street and say, I'm going to give, you know, at some later stage, and meanwhile are living a high-consuming lifestyle. I'm talking about people who are really committed to the idea of effective altruism. And from the time that they get their first paycheck, or at least let's say, you know, during the first year that they're working, they donate, let's say, 50% of what they're earning. And there are people doing this. I know people doing this. You could say we're currently engaged in a kind of social experiment because the person I know who's been doing this longest has been doing it maybe 4 or 5 years. And he has been every year so far donating at least 50% of his income. So, you know, there are other people. There are moderate number. You know, I'm not talking about thousands of people doing this, but I'm certainly talking about hundreds of people who are in recent years started doing this. And we'll see how they go. How well do they stick to it? How much do they donate? Are they satisfied with their life? Can they do it? I already know a couple, I have to say, who have decided this is not for me, and they've, you know, gone back to do a PhD or something else that they might have pursued previously. Well, that's okay. They've spent a couple of years doing this. They have still donated during those couple of years, and now they find out it wasn't for them. I think we, in a way, we need to wait and see. We need to say this is an interesting social experiment. How many people have the character to start giving and to keep giving and to give to highly effective charities, to not get seduced into the idea that, oh, I need to live in a six-bedroom apartment in Tribeca, or I need to drive a Maserati, or whatever it might be. How many of them continue to live modestly and give a lot? And compare that with the contributions that people make by giving to effective charities like the Against Malaria Foundation. Sorry, by working for effective charities like the Against Malaria Foundation.
Right. You use the important word seduced. You know, we are a social species, and we are very prone to being affected by the peer values around us. And if you do work for, as an investment banker for J.P. Morgan or whatever, everybody's got the stupid Rolex. Everybody's got the stupid 4,000-square-foot house who's aiming for five. Everybody who's got the 300-series Mercedes wants the 500-series Mercedes. So you can almost, you know, there's this theory called cognitive dissonance that people just can't handle too much dissonance between their values and that of the peer group. So wouldn't, in this social experiment, wouldn't one be wise to bet on the fact that even those who left the university with good, progressive, liberal, radical redistributionist values, when they're in the belly of the capitalist beast, aren't going to be seduced to the Rolex lifestyle?
Well, let's see, is what I would say to that. So far, the indications, and I wish I had more and better data, but so far the indications are that they're not, that they're continuing to live modestly and donate. And after all, what this means is, if you like, that we've got a seed planted in Wall Street that could start to turn around I agree, absurd Rolex lifestyle. I mean, why would anyone pay $5,000 for a watch that doesn't keep the time any better than the $100 Casio that I've got on my wrist now?
Or the $20 Casio. Fact, right.
Yeah, even the $20, right? Okay, I lashed out. Yeah, I want one with alarm functions and all the rest of it, right?
But, well, you can get that for $20 too, but we digress.
Can I?
Yeah, really, really. At Walmart, I just bought one, $23.97. It's got the alarms, it's got everything, and really a beautiful modern design, but I absolutely digress, and I shouldn't. You know, what is even more dispiriting, I was watching the debate last night, and I listened to the two of them falling over themselves at who is going to do more to bring back American jobs. From an ethical perspective, especially the Peter Singer liberal version of utilitarianism, that's absurd. Why should we care more, from an ethical perspective, about bringing a job, keeping a job, or bringing a job back, quote unquote, to America, when indeed the value of that job in terms of improving the lifestyle of somebody in Burundi, in sub-Saharan Africa, is so much greater? Why should we feel any greater affiliation to somebody in Bakersfield than somebody in Burundi? What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. We shouldn't. When jobs go overseas, they are doing more to reduce poverty than when they stay in the United States, assuming they go to a poor country, as you say, like Burundi. We should really welcome it. And the problem is, of course, that the protagonists in the debate last night were trying to win the votes of Americans. They were not trying to win the votes of citizens of the world as a whole. And that's a problem with the global system, I suppose, that we have, but we're stuck with it. I wish people were prepared to point this out and that more people were prepared to say, I'm voting for a better world, not necessarily for more jobs for Americans. But that's not a good election cell.
Right, exactly. A priori, you would think that human beings would feel greater affiliation with the world than some accident of geography called the United States of America, which arguably were appropriated unfairly. And yet people really do, and I'm not just talking about red meat people in very red states. We're talking about people in California. We're talking about unions. We're talking about every even very progressive, most progressive people are thinking about America first. Where do you think the genesis of that change of affiliation from being a world citizen to a literal chauvinist come from?
Yes, I suppose it comes from the fact that we are encultured to think of our nation first, and this is very true of Americans, but of course it's true of a lot of other countries, that engender a kind of a nationalism, and the fact that the political systems are geared around those national boundaries mean that we're much more likely to think this way. That's why I favor getting involved in larger entities. I think it's a tragedy that Britain is now going to leave the European Union. I think the European Union was exactly such a mechanism for broadening the concern of Britons and French and others to at least a larger group, even if not worldwide. But I'd hope that it was part of this trend that would broaden things to more worldwide. Unfortunately, it seems like at the moment we're in a backward phase where we're going in the opposite direction. I hope that there will be more enlightened times ahead where this will turn around.
I would argue that it is not just in these times. I think whether it be an evolutionary survival instinct or something else, the individual desire for self-aggrandizement, self-acquisition, is very, very hardwired, and not just in this capitalist country. You can point to some outliers, but in general, for over the millennia, people in general, all these pacts, for example, internation pacts are only adhered to as long as they're expedient. And as soon as the selfish interest of China or India or whatever, suddenly the pact, they find a way out of the pact. And that's true of contracts in general. Individual athletes who are worth millions, as soon as they can get out of the contract, they can make 50,000 more. So isn't there the liberal ideal is lovely? Who would argue against the ideal? But the way human beings function over the millennia is, in the end, with exceptions, of course, but on average, to focus on taking care of number one first. They vote their pocketbook. They will be friendly and nice and smiley until it's inexpedient, and then they'll go for the jugular. Is that a fair statement?
It's a little on the cynical side, I think. I mean, obviously, that is an element of our nature. I can't deny that you've put your finger on something. That is a persistent strain in human nature, that we identify with the group that we're in. For most of our evolutionary history, of course, it's been much smaller groups. It's been small tribal groups. Lately, we've shifted, lately as in the last couple of hundred years, we've shifted towards the nation-state kind of group. I'm hoping still that we are shifting beyond a number of the problems we face are global, not national. No nation, for example, can solve the problem of climate change, which is a real problem and which we have to start to make global progress towards. And perhaps the Paris Agreement was a step towards that, but we haven't yet seen it fulfilled, of course, in terms of their full implementation. But there are those problems. There are problems of peace. There are a range of problems that really require global solutions. And so I hope and believe that we will start to develop stronger global institutions, and that eventually, but it may take a long time still, eventually we will start to think more as global citizens than as citizens of individual sovereign states.
Let's turn back to work, because that is my mandate here. But first, let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My very special guest, Peter Singer, professor at Princeton of Ethics. His famous book is Practical Ethics, and his most recent book, just published, Ethics in the Real World, 82 Brief Essays on Things That Matter. Oh, you need to know this, dear listeners, and you know I don't always say this, his writing is crystalline. He is not like academic philosophers who write in figurative hieroglyphics. He is an easy read and a pleasure to read, and so I do commend the book to you. Turning to work, the federal government is now pressuring employers to not consider whether a job applicant has a felony on his record. There are ethical issues on both sides of that question. What are your thoughts on both sides of that question?
So my thoughts are that a felon has paid the price for the felony and deserves a chance. Now, you know, I say deserves a chance, and that means to get into the workforce, because, of course, if somebody cannot get into the workforce, then they're very likely to go back to crime as a way of supporting themselves and surviving. Now, there may be cases, of course, where a felon gets a chance and doesn't take that chance, commits further felonies, maybe against the employer, even depending on the nature of the offences. Those people, I think, then deserve to be punished more severely next time. And there might come a point where you feel somebody has such a bad record of repeated felonies that you can't really consider them for employment. It's not fair to the fellow employees or to the workplace or the customers. So I wouldn't, you know, say that this is something that is exceptionless. But in general, I would say the felon has paid the price and deserves another chance.
You've circumscribed the argument in terms of only the impacts on the felon. Let's look at the broader stakeholders. If I am, for example, a person who has, we all have impulses to do things illegal. We were a kid, we might want to steal that pair of shoes. We might want to, you know, beat somebody up. And we've nonetheless pulled on ropes of restraint, and we have lived a life without a felony. And now, in the zero-sum game of a tight job market where good jobs are very difficult to get, good ethical jobs, good paying jobs, stable jobs in a reasonable geographic location are difficult to get, it's a zero-sum game. And now I, as somebody who has pulled on those ropes of restraint for decades, am told by our federal government that I cannot have an advantage even over a felon who may have had a career record of burglaring, robbing, and raping. What would you say ethically to that person who has chosen to live the ethical life?
So, I mean, you set a career record of burglaring, robbing, and raping. I mean, as I said in my previous remark, there comes a point where there are repeated offences where I think that should not be ignored. But if we're simply talking about somebody who has a felony conviction, and there's a wide range of felony convictions, and people do it at different ages of their life and might well have moved on completely to a different lifestyle, then I think the employer ought to employ the best qualified person for the job, taking into account the fact that this person has a felony conviction that they have paid for in the sense of having served time for it or whatever the legal punishment was. So I think if they're better qualified than the other person, you know, in all other respects, if they're better qualified than the other person who did not commit the felony, they should be given that chance to take that job and to show that they merit it and can hold it and can do a good job with it.
Well, let's look at the other stakeholders. You know, we there is no perfect predictability, but let's say it was one time, one armed robbery. Well, let's take rape out of it because it's got an emotional component to it. So let's just say one armed robbery, and there are, you know, as you well know, for good jobs, there are 50, 100 applicants for each job, and there's no guaranteed predictability. But we know the recidivism rate is very high among armed robbers, and so that person would have to be head and shoulders, and there are very few armed robbers who are head and shoulders in terms of skill set, ability, and predictive likelihood of being kind and gentle to co-workers, to be a, you know, to have the impulse control to delay gratification and work really hard. These, the people who do commit armed robbery are generally people with lacking impulse control. So unless that person really stood out in every other regard and it really was a one-time offense, and there are very few one-time offenders, wouldn't the argument, you know, for the federal government to say you can't hold a felony against an applicant and therefore privilege somebody who is not committed a felony, isn't that a cosmic injustice?
I think cosmic injustice is putting it a little high, really. Don't forget, this person has been convicted of an armed robbery. They presumably spent several years in prison for that armed robbery. They may well have changed during that time. I accept that there is a rate of recidivism, that not all do, but I do think that society ought to give people convicted of felonies a chance to prove themselves. You know, if this person is, in other respects, the best qualified for the job, they should get it. If they're not, in other respects, the best qualified for the job, of course they shouldn't get it. I'm certainly not advocating affirmative action for felons. Don't get me wrong there, right? But it's just I'm saying that fact that some years ago they committed this felony for which they've done their time should not debar them from getting the job if they are, in other respects, the best qualified applicant.
One more push on this. The a key stakeholder, of course, is coworkers. And for many, many people, one of the most important things that they value is safety. Psychological safety from being yelled at, certainly physical safety. And now imagine that I am the boss, and I have had a good job opening, and there were the usual 10, 20, 50, 100 applicants. And I said, by my lawyer, the corporate lawyer is going to make me disclose, because if not, I'm going to get sued. I'm going to say, we'd made a decision to hire somebody who had an armed robbery. Think about it as a coworker. And aren't you feeling, at minimum psychologically, less safe than you deserve to because of this new federal pressure to hire, to not privilege, if you will, people who didn't commit felonies? What would you say to those coworkers?
Well, I mean, again, it perhaps is going to depend on the nature of the offense, but I think that coworkers should be able to see that people ought to be given a chance to show that they've put their past behind them and that they're going to be good colleagues. Now, if they start, you know, even short of committing further crimes, if they start abusing and yelling at their coworkers or threatening them in some way, they should be out the door. I mean, it should be made clear that that's not acceptable behavior in the workplace. But if they're just doing their job as anyone else would, I think the co-workers will start to relax, will start to get comfortable with it. They know this person. This is a human being. I can relate to this person. Whatever he's done in the past, it's over and he's a different person now.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My special guest is Peter Singer, the author of the famous classic book called Practical Ethics and just published Ethics in the Real World, 82 Brief Essays on Things That Matter. We're talking about ethical, practical issues in the workplace. Here's another one. You talked about global warming, climate change, the environment. Well, current requirement, you're talking about the Paris Accords, but certainly we have in California far more restrictive thing, for example, where there's no freeways being allowed to be built for the next 30 years, even though it means that people can't travel. They can't. They really do sit in gridlock. It took me an hour to get here in the middle of the day on a weekday to go 10 miles, and spewing pollutants, I might add. So, but current and planned environmental requirements, especially like in manufacturing, they raise the cost of items. There are ethical issues. I'll make the argument, and so you can maybe respond to it. Obviously, the argument in favor of it is that those regulations we hope are going to benefit humankind's safety, and that justifies making customers pay more, even though paying more disproportionately affects the poor because the rich can afford to pay more. The counterargument is that the probability is small that the environmental benefits of making an environmentally safer piece of plastic or a product or whatever is going to outweigh the 100% likelihood that people, especially the poor people, have to pay more. What are your ethical thoughts on the issue of imposing greater environmental regulations, thereby increasing the cost of products?
Look, rather than say that the environmental regulations are going to mean that the manufacturing goods cost more, I would rather say at present these goods are cheap because they are passing on part of the cost to other completely innocent third parties. And they're what economists call externalities.
Right.
So the costs have not been internalized in the cost of the product at the checkout because the costs are being experienced by everybody who is affected by the pollution, by the climate change, you know, whatever it might be. There are different kinds of costs. Of course, some of them will be imposed locally by local pollution. Some of them will be imposed globally by climate change and all sorts of other costs. So I think it's wrong that the manufacturing process should harm people who have nothing to do with it, who are neither profiting from it nor benefiting from the cheap products. And the full cost for everyone of the manufacturing process should be incorporated in the product at the price point so that people can therefore see that the products that cause less harm are not more expensive at the end, as they now are, because of the greater precautions taken to avoid pollution. Because the true cost of the other product is now built into the price. So I think that that is a reasonable thing to do and a necessary thing to do if we're going to avoid these environmental problems.
Great. So let's stipulate to the fact that you're right. It's an open question, but let's stipulate that you're right, that the price of every item should include the externalities, the cost to society, etc. And so now the price of product X, as Mary Jones goes into the supermarket, and it used to be a dollar, and now it is fully priced and it is $2. What do you say to Mary, who, and it's not just one item, of course, we're talking about her whole market basket of expenses, everything she buys from her front doormat to her Lysol cleaner, to her food, to her shelter, to everything. She now sees the cost of living where she's already living on the edge. And you're saying, well, you know, you didn't count the externalities, and so I'm sorry it's costing you 30% more or 40% more. What do you say to Mary Jones?
I say it is unfortunate, and you may make life harder for you. If you are indeed living on the edge, then it certainly will make life harder for you. We can talk about social arrangements that try to alter that. I mean, people have suggested, for example, carbon taxes, that then the revenue that the state takes in goes out again to those who are the poorest and who are suffering the most from those increased prices. We can talk about mechanisms like that. But in any case, you know, Mary was benefiting from the fact that the manufacturing process was harming these third parties who had nothing to do with it. And that shouldn't continue. And if Mary can understand that, she should be able to understand why she's paying more, even if she nevertheless doesn't like it.
Okay. When I interviewed you in Psychology Today, you said something very interesting. You said you thought it was wiser to make efforts to stop blindness in the poorest countries rather than restore school programs for intellectually gifted kids because it was a sure thing. Does that argue, then, for our reallocating our education budget to healthcare because it's a sure thing?
Well, no, not entirely. We do need to have education. I, you know, would hate to think what would happen to this country if we abandoned.
No, some. Let's say reallocating some. Because a lot of it. Let me just add one more thing. There's a lot of evidence that spending more beyond a very minimal amount does not improve educational outcomes. The United States spends, and please, dear listeners, email me if you don't believe this. We spend number one or number two in the world per capita on education, and yet our achievement in the international comparisons flounders near the very bottom of the 34 OECD, that is the developed nations. So spending a lot. So I'm merely asking, given that you say it's a surer bet that incremental spending beyond basic education is less likely, you've argued, is less likely to do good than health care, do you think we should reallocate, say, even 25% of our education budget to health care?
To health care in the United States? I mean,
we'll
the problem
start
with
that. We'll move to the third world nations in a moment.
Because I was going to say the problem with that is that we also spend a higher proportion of our gross domestic product on health care than any other country in the world, and yet we're not getting better health outcomes than many other countries. So what this suggests is that, you know, we really need to do something about both the healthcare system and the education system to get better value for the money that we're putting into it. So I wouldn't advocate reallocating the education budget to healthcare as it is in the United States. It's a very costly enterprise.
Right.
Now, if you're going to go on and ask me about should we allocate it to healthcare in developing countries,
right?
So, yes, I'm inclined to think that we would be getting better value for a lot of our spending if we could do that. Again, it goes back to what we're talking about, what the, Clinton and Trump were saying in the debate. It doesn't look like any politician is really going to be able to suggest doing that. But given that you know, you can save a life in a developing country for maybe $3,000, you know, one estimate, prevent people dying from malaria, and that doesn't go very far in terms of the kinds of sums we spend on our school system, reallocating some of that to pick the low-hanging fruit where healthcare in developing countries can do the most good, save the most lives, restore people to health, make them effective workers and family supporters again. I wouldn't object to that.
So what is the career implications of this, which is if you are either in education or aspiring to be in education in the United States of America, might it be worth your reconsidering? If you're really, you know, every single educator I've ever met says they're going into it to make a difference. They're not doing it because they want the summers off and they want the short days. They say, I want to make a difference. I want to change lives. Fine. If that's really primary for you, should you reconsider whether you're going to be just another teacher in the United States? And we all know the data on, you know, my PhD is in the evaluation of education. It is amazingly how recalcitrant educational progress is to almost every innovation that is in my lifetime I've experienced. So if you really want to make a difference, as Peter Singer is saying, you can cure blindness for, $100 a person, or a mosquito net costs $5 and can stop malaria. Shouldn't you, dear listener, who's in education or contemplating it, get your butt to either, you know, to sub-Saharan Africa or work for a nonprofit here in this country that helps the poorest people with their health care? What do you think of that argument, Peter?
It's definitely a career option, and it's tough to say it, but yes, given the problems with the education system in this country, it may be a very frustrating experience to go into that in order to make a difference. And it may be that there are projects in developing countries of the kind that you've just described where you will be able to make more of a difference. So if you're prepared to do that, of course, not everyone is prepared to give up the security and comfort of life in the United States, even teaching in an inner city school, for going to a developing country. But if you're prepared to do that, I think that that's a very laudable thing to do. But I'm also prepared to support people who say, look, I'm going to go into education in the United States because it is ultimately important, and I'm going to go in there with a sense of seeing where are the problems? Is there something I can do? Can I get together with others to try to make a change? And, you know, I accept, as you said, the system is recalcitrant to change, and that's a terrible problem. But I wouldn't want to give up hope entirely that we will be able to make a difference there.
What was implicit again was, you know, you can understand the choice of people that are not willing to sacrifice the comforts of being in America to go and live in Djibouti. But you yourself, you know, are certainly much more exemplary of walking your talk than 98% of people. You have given away far more money than have most people, and yet you still live at a significantly higher standard of living than necessary to do your work. I mean, let's just take the example you gave. You bought $100 watch. No, you didn't buy a Rolex, of course, because that, you know, that would have meant you were into pre-senility. But you bought $100 Casio when there really are $20 with the exact same movement. You know, the quartz movement that is accurate within a few seconds per month, and you spent $100 where $98 could have bought a half a dozen or more mosquito nets to save kids from malaria. You, in my interview with Psychology Today, you said that it was survival instinct. But isn't there more really? What really, beyond survival instinct, you're well beyond the survival level, what really do you think governs even this enlightened person, Peter Singer's, decision to live, to spend money on things that are far less essential than a mosquito net for somebody in the Congo?
Okay. Maybe on the watch I made a mistake. Maybe I could have got an equivalently good watch for less. I suppose I didn't put enough time into doing the research.
But you live in a nice house in Princeton. You live in a house that you could save countless lives by selling your house in Princeton and living in a basement apartment in Newark.
I agree. I do live a lifestyle that is certainly higher than I need in order to continue doing my work. And I'm not saying that I have a really good ethical justification for that, right? I'm saying that I'm not a saint. I have not pushed things as far as I could go. As you said, I think I go further than you said 98%. I'll take that if you like. 98% Americans in Definitely. Terms of the way I live and the Definitely. Amount that I give.
Yep.
There are limits for me too, where I think if I were a better person, I would go further, but there are things that I'm not prepared to give up.
Yeah. I guess that's part of our being human. Conservatives are endlessly calling limousine liberals who don't walk their talk, you know, the Barbara Streisands who sing for people to give to Burundi while they have a $100 million pink diamond collection that they simply stare at that does no good for the world. What do you say to the conservatives who call liberals absolutely Luftmenches, pie head in the sky, talk is cheap, but in the end, they don't give themselves any pain. Even, you know, Mark Zuckerberg just donated $3 billion, 98% of his shares of Facebook stock, and yet he still lives like a king. So it didn't give him any pain. So it's no, he got all kinds of PR benefit for doing it, but in the end, he's still living, you know, unbelievably royally. So what do you say to the conservatives who say all these pious liberals are just hypocrites?
Well, some of them may be hypocrites. I'm not going to specifically comment on Mark Zuckerberg because I don't know enough about his lifestyle. But yes, there are certainly liberal hypocrites. And of course, there are conservative hypocrites who attack government and call for small government while not paying their taxes. Or, you know, there might be farmers who are getting huge agricultural subsidies. So there are plenty of hypocrites on both sides of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And the proper response to that, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, is to say, I'm going to live in accordance with my values. And I do think that there are more people doing this. I think the effective altruism movement that I write about in the book you've mentioned, Ethics in the Real World, the effective altruism movement is bringing young people to think about living their values in a way that has been pretty unusual before. And I'm speaking to groups all over the country with a lot of enthusiasm about that, about effective altruism and about ways of living, and I hope that this will be planting the seeds of change. I'm involved with an organization called The Life You Can Save, which is encouraging people to live more altruistically and to find effective charities that they can give to. So I'm actively working, not simply as a professor, but also through this nonprofit, The Life You Can Save, to try to change people's views about the importance of living what they think their values are rather than just talking the talk.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Peter Singer, professor of ethics at Princeton and author of many books, the classic Practical Ethics and brand new Ethics in the Real World, 82 brief essays on the things that matter. On the 15 minutes or so we have left, I'm going to turn to you with your permission. This show is about work and career. So I like thought experiments, so let's create a thought experiment, which is that we press reset on your life. You know now, you have all the wisdom and knowledge and experience that you've had in your years on this earth, but you're now 16 years old. You're, say, a senior in high school. What kind of thoughts would be going through your mind as to what Peter Singer would do career-wise?
So, do I have the option of living the career that I have?
Yes, you have all options. Everything
outcomes?
Every option is available.
Okay.
You're 16 years old.
So I think I've been extremely fortunate in my career choice in that I went into philosophy because I was interested in it. I liked arguments. But I gravitated towards ethics because I wanted to be involved in something that does make a difference to the world, that ordinary people will talk about. I wasn't interested in philosophical discussions of
right.
How do I know that I'm not dreaming now, that you know,
there's
some evil demon who's created the world that I think exists. I went into it, you know, without too much thought about how it might make a difference. But as it's turned out, I think my life and career has made a significant positive difference in the world, you know, through the books I've been writing, the talks I give, and so on. So I've been extremely fortunate. If I knew that I could repeat that and do the same thing again, I would. But if I was just a 16-year-old who was just, you know, thinking about going into academic life in the chance that I might make a difference, where you're competing with so many other very talented people and you know, I think, I was very fortunate. I would not think that the odds of my having such a positive impact would be very high. And so I would probably start thinking about different kinds of careers. A lot of people now, of course, are thinking about some tech startup, which could make a big difference to the world. They're looking at some of the wonderful examples of things like Google that have made a huge positive difference mm-hmm. to the world. Mm-hmm. If I thought I had the talent for that, I might well be attracted to that. And again, of course, if you're successful, not only has your product hopefully made a positive difference, but you then have a lot of money that you can make a positive difference with as well. So if you've got a good got a reasonable chance of success at that, that's definitely a good thing to do as well.
Good.
But, you know, I'm not going to reject any of the other options, including working for a nonprofit. I think if you find the right nonprofit and you have the right talents, you can definitely make an important difference in that way. And since we're in the election season, even though the U.S. political system is, you know, not the best vehicle for translating talent into positive change, I wouldn't discourage people who think that they can make a difference there, because it's just incredibly important. And so even if there's just a small chance of nudging the system in a more positive direction, you could do a great deal of good.
How did you know, most academics, again, we are sucked in by our immediate environment and culture. The world of philosophy is dominated by academic philosophers who are counting the number of angels on a head of a pin. What, either internally or externally, enabled you to retain that, I think, important recognition that practicality trumps all of that academic stuff?
Well, I think I entered philosophy at a fortunate time. Philosophy had been through a period when it was really, I think, quite sterile. It was the period known as linguistic analysis.
Right.
It was analyzing the meanings of moral words, whether moral words or other words. In fact, philosophers, A.J. Ayer, who was a famous mm-hmm. professor of mm-hmm. philosophy, as an example, were disavowing the idea that moral philosophy can be a guide to what you ought to do. In fact, you know, there's a quote I sometimes use. He says it would be silly as well as presumptuous to look to the moral philosopher for guidance. Mm. Now, if that had continued to be the prevailing ethos in philosophy, so that if my teachers at Oxford, I did my graduate work at Oxford University, if my teachers at Oxford had given me a poor grade because they said what you're trying to do is not philosophy, mm. you should be going back to mm. working out what these words mean, mm. I would have given up and gone to do something else. But because it was the end of the 60s and the early 70s, there was this movement for greater relevance in mm-hmm, academic mm-hmm, life. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, my professors were open, at least some of them were open to the idea of a change here, of rethinking what ethics is about, what moral philosophy is about, in a way that can make a difference. And so I think that made it possible for me to continue to do this. And once I started writing and building up a readership, I think one of the books that you didn't mention that had an influence is Animal Liberation. Mm-hmm. So that was my second book. I was 29, I think, at the time it came out. And once that had established a reputation and shown people that philosophy did make a difference, I think from then on it was much easier.
Yeah. I'm going to make an argument that perhaps we deify and assume as a given that democracy and electing our leaders is the wisest approach. I'd like to make an argument from a utilitarian perspective that the country, especially given what empirically we see, what our electoral process yields, and I think that even if we had 100% public-funded campaigns, we would still, people willing to put up with all the crap it takes to get elected are not going to be our best and brightest. And although I don't agree with you completely, I'm not as far left as you are in redistribution, I do recognize the importance of your perspective, and it is certainly a legitimate one. What if I argued that our government should not be elected, the public, especially in an era of ever greater manipulation by Madison Avenue, very sophisticated, psychographically brilliant people, the public is just not sophisticated enough to endure that, and that there needs to be kind of a passive system by which really some of our most circumspect, I don't know if that's really the right word, our most thoughtful human beings, a Peter Singer and perhaps somebody from the right who's a philosopher, kinglet, maybe four or five people, too big the committee and nothing gets done, but four or five of the most wise people who are not economically, not driven by money or power, but who are really some of the wisest human beings, whether we net would, from a utilitarian perspective, have a better country with more good for more people in the world. Forget about the country. If we had a team of philosopher kings and queens and similar such people from a variety of backgrounds, but who are unquestionably thoughtful. What do you think about the pros and cons of that as a model for government?
If you're asking the question, would such a group of people be likely to do better as government than whatever the democratic process throws up under the present system, it's quite possible that it would. But the problem is, how do you get this system where you select this group of wise people? Because, of course, who counts as wise is highly contested. And a lot of your listeners, I suppose, would be horrified by your suggestion that I should be on this committee. They wouldn't like my views at all. And you know, then whoever we pick from the right, other people will be horrified by them. So that's always the question, you know, how do you get the right people in office?
There's an answer to that. You know, right now we all, in the world of investments, we talk about investment banking, it is orthodoxy that the smartest way to do investing is passive through some external criteria. In the area of investing, it's the 500 largest companies become the S&P 500. But in this case, if we had, for example, the most cited philosopher, that would be a criterion that would be a, and if we were going to look, it would say we valued education. I don't mean to denigrate education. Let's say the teacher of the U.S. teacher of the year, or a scientist a Nobel Prize winner who was the most recent Nobel Prize winner. So you could create some objective, unarguable criteria that isn't perfect. Perfect is the enemy of the good. But compared to the system by which we choose our leaders now, one would argue that you'd get a hell of a better set of outcomes from a utilitarian perspective. What do you think?
Well, you might, but I mean, the fact that someone gets a Nobel Prize for some piece of scientific research doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be great at governing, and the fact that the philosopher gets cited a lot doesn't necessarily mean that she or he is going to be great either. I think, you know, it's an interesting suggestion that, you know, and I do agree that we could certainly find better people to govern. I think that, you know, because that's probably unrealistic, I think it's more interesting to think about ways in which we can modify the political system so that it throws up better leaders rather than the kinds of ones that we have now. And I think, you know, again, coming from Australia where we have a parliamentary democracy, I think there's something to be said for a parliamentary model where you don't become leader until you win the support and confidence of your colleagues in Parliament. They've got to know you over several years during which you've been serving with them in Parliament.
Makes great sense. Let's turn back to work. We've got just a couple of minutes left. So let's project forward. You're 70 years old. You're still at the peak of game. You're doing a lot of teaching and writing, and you have a brand new book of essays, which great. Love it. I'm a career counselor during the week. You know, I am not an incendiary during the week. I'm a plain old career counselor, you know, Clark Kent, Sue, whatever. If you could ask me as a career counselor any one question that would be aimed toward abetting your work life in your next 3 years, 5 years, tomorrow, whatever, is there a question you'd like to ask me?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Well, I suppose, are there ways in which I could use my time more effectively? I have a lot of problems with time management in terms of trying to decide which of the various invitations that I have to spend my time, including talking to you, of course.
Right.
That's one of them, which I've chosen to be a valuable one, but there are many others. Can you advise me on how I can have a better way of selecting?
I like to work from the concrete. So I'm going to work from the concrete, and I'm going to pose a very specific piece of suggestion, and you tell me what you like and don't like about it. We are living in a world where your goal is influence. Your goal is change. It's not money. We live in the world of the one-minute video. I would argue that you need to team up with some people at Princeton, students, tech people, whatever, to create one, just like Robert Reich has done, one-minute videos that are designed to change people's minds about something you care about. So that is consistent with your value. What do you like and not like about that idea? Because that can get viewed by millions of people, you know, instantly with a relatively small amount of effort on your part.
I like that idea. I must admit it's not something that I particularly considered. So Rob Reich is doing this and is getting millions of people viewing the videos that he's doing?
Yep. Or hundreds of thousands. You know, I don't know. Many.
Hundreds of thousands. Okay.
Certainly
yeah,
more
many,
than
many,
are listening to this radio show, I promise you.
Okay. And more than are going to read Ethics in the Real World, even
Correct.
Though I hope it will be a huge bestseller.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Okay, I'll quit while I'm ahead. One last question because we're just about out of time. You told me that you hike and you surf to keep from burning out. We've got a very interesting work life, and you have significant control over it, which is key to keeping stress under control. What exists in your work life that requires you to hike and surf?
I think the fact that my work life is very sedentary, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, I'm sitting here now talking
right,
to you. If
right.
I weren't sitting to you, talking to you, I would be sitting at my computer writing stuff or answering emails. And if I weren't doing that, I would be teaching a class, which depending whether it's a seminar class or a lecture, I guess I may be sitting, I may be pacing mm-hmm. up and down across the platform. But anyway, basically it's an indoors, pretty sedentary life. And I do feel that I need to get outside.
You do.
I do have a strong feeling for nature, and both hiking and surfing mm-hmm. get me mm-hmm. out into a natural environment. I really do feel that that helps me to recharge my batteries and gives me more energy for what I'm going to be doing afterwards.
Yeah, they say sitting is the new smoking. And, you know, Peter, I certainly want you to keep doing what you're doing for a long time. And I can't think of, even from a utilitarian perspective, I think we all need, me too, I make a rule these days. You know, I am also extremely sedentary. I write and I counsel and I do radio shows and stuff. And I'm sitting on my butt all the time. And I make myself, thanks to my good doggy Einstein, we go out, you know, about every hour. I just make my butt go out and garden or hike or whatever. And so, dear listeners, again, to you, even if you're a workaholic, crazy person like me, I don't know how hard Peter works, but you got to get your butt out. Even from a utilitarian, make a difference, make money perspective, please do that. And on that note, Peter Singer, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. I really enjoyed engaging with you. I hope it wasn't intolerable to you.
Not at all. It was, in fact, really fascinating. I've enjoyed it a lot. Thanks for having me on the program.
I wish you all the best, of course, Peter. Anyway, his book, and I really do, he writes in a crystalline way and in a variety of topics, everything from sports doping to the environment, a million different topics. He's a smart guy. You want to read smart guys who write crystallinely, if that's a word. The book is Ethics in the Real World, 82 Brief Essays on the Things That Matter, and that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my engineer, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and also, of course, all of you for listening. Please, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemko's articles, information on his 8 books, including his new book, The Best of Marty Nemko, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemko.com. That's Marty, NEMKO.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.